Hello and welcome to Science Unscripted. It's Connor here.
And Gib.
We are going to begin with an email.
Yep.
Usually do that. And yep. This one, I guess to preface it, usually when we read an email out that is quite critical of us or critical of something on this show, I kind of expect that if we do that on the show, on the air, which is what we did last week, that the person listening to our rebuttal of their email
doubles down.
No, I kind of expect that we lose them. In this case, we didn't.
Last week, the email was from Grumpy. This week, the email was from not quite so Grumpy. And he writes, "Thanks for the readout of my email. Boy, do I sound like a cranky old man who hates children. Wow. I didn't mean to come across quite that strongly, and thanks for setting me right on my rant. I guess all I was getting at is what you said. People can and do have a fully meaningful life with or without kids." And again, that was with regard to an interview we did at Cologne University where it was about what having a child does for you with regard to your satisfaction.
Drops it.
Absolutely.
You're less satisfied at that moment.
But also your meaning in life, whether your life has a purpose, where that obviously then goes up. And Grumpy at that point thought that we were saying that having kids will make your life meaningful. It's the only way to make your life meaningful. We kind of said, no, that's not what we said. And Not So Grumpy says, "I think what I was trying to get at is the pressure a lot of people face to have children when it would be the worst thing for everyone involved, including the kids. And that is wrong for others to do that." Absolutely.
100%.
You're absolutely right, Not So Grumpy.
We've had conversations in here at DW amongst colleagues. I think, Gabe, you and I are part of the generation where that was certainly the expectation. You kind of were a failure if you didn't produce more little human beings.
You certainly had to explain yourself.
Yeah. There was a lot of social pressure. And for better and for worse, it depends on your perspective, that seems to have fundamentally shifted, where it may even be the case now, I'm not part of the youngest generation to know this, where you have to justify why you want to have children.
Or you have to explain yourself if you actually
this is why I'm doing it. So things have shifted a lot. But what I want to say more than anything else is thank you for the second email saying, like, boy, did I sound like a crank. It takes some real self-reflection to be able to, I don't know, send that second email and talk about yourself that way.
Yeah.
We're going to start with kind of, it connects to something we also talked about last week. Last week, I was talking about the Vera C. Rubin Observatory, which had just opened on a mountain in Chile, looking at the southern hemisphere, mapping our night sky.
And the images that they were sending in.
Incredible. Yeah. The number of asteroids it has found has already doubled. They're at 4,000 asteroids. Pay attention. Go to the website. You can get wallpaper for your computer or for your phone. And just see incredible stuff. This is from a different observatory, not the Vera C. Rubin, in Chile, looking at the night sky and finding the third ever interstellar object hurtling into our solar system. Not like roughly toward our solar system. It's not going to pass by, I don't know, one of the outermost planets. It's going to cut right through our solar system. This object is now called 3I. So third interstellar,
yes.
/ Atlas. Atlas is the NASA-funded project that is trying to find big, huge rocks or comets.
Okay, so that was my question. What are we talking about in terms of interstellar object? Is this a gigantic rock that's flying through?
Yeah.
Or what is it?
A comet seems to be the assumption right now. In fact, I was kind of surprised that after looking at this with, I think, now 100-plus different telescopes, there isn't certainty on exactly what it is. It could be a darker asteroid. It could be a lighter comet. They're still figuring out exactly how large this thing is. I've seen upper estimates of 12 miles in diameter. Just a reminder that the extinction level or the dinosaur killer comet was, I believe, roughly 6 miles in diameter. This would be kind of twice that, but much more in terms of mass. That's the uppermost model of what it could be. It's probably smaller than that. It's moving toward our solar system, into our solar system. You have to find some sort of reference point. Is it in reference to Earth or to Mars or to what? In reference to the sun, it's moving at 130,000 miles an hour. I think a rifle bullet is close to 3,000. So this is 40 times the speed of a rifle bullet.
Okay.
And so, of course, people get alarmed.
That's what I'm saying. You're kind of scaring me.
Oh my gosh! And that's what I want. I want to make everyone nice and calm. Don't worry, we're fine. We're totally fine. Between now, the moment you're hearing this, and October 30th, if you're a celebrator of Halloween,
it's almost Halloween.
Yeah, or Dia de los Muertos or whatever. This is going to be right before that. That it gets at its closest point to Earth, and it's not very close. It's going to be inside of Mars. That's kind of close. Sure. Right now, it's between Jupiter and the asteroid belt, and it'll go through the asteroid belt, go past Mars, and then it continues somewhere.
Are we going to be able to see it fly by?
Amazingly,
with our naked eyes?
Not with the naked eye. If you have a telescope, they didn't define what. I was thinking about my four-incher, my four-inch telescope that I love. There is a possibility, and the nice thing is you can take a look at this, possibly, and at the very least, if you're sitting with people having a cup of coffee or tea or whatever your beverage of choice is, you can be the informed one. And when someone's like, oh my gosh, scary, something's flying toward Earth, you can be like, oh, do you mean Three-Eye Atlas? That interstellar object that's going to, you know, fly in between us and Mars just before Halloween? Is that what you mean?
That's a 12-mile-long rock.
And that part is unsubstantiated. So that's the maximum.
Yeah, close.
But anyway, that is the news. And the last thing I'll say is that Vera C. Rubin, that new telescope in Chile, is going to find a lot more objects like these. This is the third time ever. Give it a while, and we'll have many more coming our way.
We normally talk about studies. That there was not necessarily a study, but what we're about to talk about next is also not a study. But when it comes to being informed, this might be good for you if you're looking to know things about the world, because you showed me a couple days ago, Connor, an interview that was aired on the New York Times. It's on a podcast with a man named Peter Thiel.
Yeah.
Who the New York Times themselves described as possibly the most influential right-wing intellectual in the world. This guy has unfathomable influence.
Yeah.
Economically, technologically, Peter Thiel being the founder of Palantir Technologies.
Palantir is a kind of surveillance tool used by governments around the world, in a limited manner here in Germany as well, but kind of controversially.
Yeah.
And the other thing I would add is, as the New York Times put right at the top, Peter Thiel, one of the early quote-unquote investors in politicians like the current U.S. president and vice president. He is I believe has described himself as a libertarian in the past, but he's got a concoction of ideas. And the reason we're talking about this at all is I believe this was possibly one of the most important interviews of the year, and that it will remain that way until the end of this year. And it's an hour long. You don't need to sit through that hour. You probably can't because you don't have a subscription to the New York Times. We do.
That's a good point.
Yeah, and we sat through it. And we think there's so much to talk about there. There's one thing that we feel is important and that should be addressed on the show, and it's that in it, he's pitching a narrative. He's pitching a narrative, and it's important to know what that is and what he's saying.
It's been a narrative that seems to be almost a guiding principle that he's been following for over the past 10 years. He wrote an essay initially describing his ideas of stagnation in 2015. He's still thinking this way, and he has constant discussions with the most important people in the world, economically, again, technologically. He speaks, it seems, all the time with Elon Musk and those politicians that you mentioned. So it's worth talking about and dissecting his big ideas.
Right.
Because they will change the course of the world, possibly.
Politicians here in Germany as well, or here in Europe as well. So this
CDU, CSU are literally investors in Palantir, are using Palantir technologies.
Yeah. This is a person whose ideas and narratives are shaping actual things that are happening right now and will happen in the future. So yeah. So what is it? What is it that he's saying?
Yeah, the New York Times asked him, "What do you mean by stagnation?" Again, Ross Douthat, is it just economic growth? Is it productivity growth? Are there numbers? And then he says, "This is Peter Thiel." Sure, the economic number would be, what are your living standards compared to your parents? If you're a 30-year-old millennial, how are you doing versus when your boomer parents were 30 years old? How were they doing at that time? There are intellectual questions. How many breakthroughs are we having? How do we quantify these things? What are the returns of going into research? People have run out of ideas, generally. And here's where Peter Thiel is saying that science as well. Mm-hmm. So not only the economy or from a technological perspective, science is in this age of stagnation.
So to summarize, one of the most influential right-wing thinkers, philosophers, if you want to call them that, because that is what he studied in Stanford, at Stanford, is saying to many influential people that he believes we are in a period of stagnation. And the three bullet points there, just to roughly summarize them as evidence in quotation marks, are that young people aren't doing any better than their parents. In fact, sometimes they're doing worse. That the institutions, and if you, let's say you're a scientist out there, that you're unable to make as much progress as you could before, and that finally, possibly, there's a cultural aspect to it, meaning we just don't have as many novel ideas as before, and that hence the conclusion might be to upend things and allow, you know, the people with the big ideas to operate unconstrained without, quote-unquote, big government hindering them to take us forward again. This is the argument. And I would, all we're trying to say here, I think, after Gabe and I discussed it many times throughout the week, is that first and foremost, I'm not even sure the premise is correct. Are we stagnating right now? Do you feel like we're stagnating? I feel like things are changing so fast every single day that I can hardly keep up.
Stagnation as a definition is when things are stuck. They're not moving. Things are moving too fast, I would argue.
Well, the way that young people today are growing up versus the way we grew up is already radically different, and it seems to be accelerating. So with that in mind, Gabe and I are critical or skeptical of the initial claim, not necessarily some of the evidence. I don't know. I can't judge that. Yeah. But the initial claim, but this is the narrative. And we've talked on the show about how narratives are very, very important.
Yeah. Yeah, that interview with Tom von Lahr from the University of Sydney, a professor of narratology.
Narratology.
The science of telling stories. And his point was that every story needs a hero.
You know, when you read something from a narratological perspective, you basically start looking for the things that we all know from movies and books and, you know, soap operas, video games, etc. You look for characters, you look for plot, you look for drama, all those kind of things. So you're reading, you know, policy documents and annual reports and media releases, but you don't read them for the kind of jargon policy talk. You read them and you try to find these characters and the plot and the drama and all the things you would normally expect in a movie or a book. What we know about storytelling is that one of the things that makes stories super, super effective is that things first get bad and then they get better. So they go down and then they go up again.
And this is where the title of the interview, if you find it on the New York Times, it's Peter Thiel and the Antichrist.
Yeah.
This is where you understand, when it comes to narratology, what Peter Thiel is doing, because the character or the anti-hero that he's using in his narrative is the Antichrist.
Meaning the individual or group of individuals representing all the bad things that are slowing down progress and causing stagnation. All of these environmental laws that make it, you know, harder to do things that you could do in other ways. It would dirty up the atmosphere. But all of those things, that's the anti-hero, the Antichrist.
Yes.
And people, I guess by implication, like Peter Thiel would be the hero in his telling.
These are his own words. The way the Antichrist would take over the world is to talk about Armageddon nonstop. Talk about existential risk nonstop. And this is what you need to regulate. It's the opposite of the 17th or 18th century, where the Antichrist is like some evil tech genius, evil scientist, who invents this machine to take over the world. In our world, the thing that has political resonance is the opposite. The thing that has political resonance is, we need to stop science. We need to say stop to this. And this is where, in the 17th century, I can imagine a Dr. Strangelove person taking over the world. In our world, it's far more likely to be Greta Thunberg.
The Swedish environmental activist, the face of the anti-climate change protests around the world and the supporter of government measures to reduce CO2 and methane emissions, other emissions as well.
The person in Peter Thiel's eyes who is, I guess, spreading existential fears around the world that act as a restrictive force against dynamism or the opposite of stagnation. But what we were wondering after we listened to this interview where he said that quote, why didn't anyone mention the fact that Peter Thiel, one of the world's most influential people, referred to Greta Thunberg, who is a peaceful protester for the environment, as the Antichrist? Nobody picked that up.
Yeah, it's a wonderful interview. Very, very complex. A German outlet, Die Zeit here, rightfully pointed out, should we be listening to billionaires who happen to also be kind of philosophers? Hey, one is not the same as the other. Why are we paying so much attention to this? Normally we wouldn't. This is a science program. I don't care what billionaires are spouting. They probably have a very narrow field of expertise, and global history and the machinations of mankind are probably not part of that. We're listening because this is somebody who's influencing things happening in democracies all around the world, including here in Europe. And it's important to understand what that narrative looks like, feels like, tastes like, sounds like, even if at first glance it's like, wow, this is really crazy, wild, anti-Christ? What? Yeah. But this is a story that's being told.
It's good to understand where someone like this is coming from, I think.
Yeah.
Because it possibly shows you where he and with him other very important and influential people are headed.
Right. And I guess I would go back to the very first premise before getting into the complexities of all the evidence and who represents what. Do you believe that we're in a period of stagnation? Are Gabe and I wrong when we say we feel like things are accelerating faster and faster to the point that it's hard to keep up, at least with the technological innovations, but also in the field of cancer research, all these other fields that some of which we can't possibly understand all the way to the bottom or top. Is it moving faster, or do you feel that it's not?
I've got a piece of plastic on my arm that if I touch another piece of plastic to it, I know what my blood sugar is.
Yeah.
It's better. I like that a lot better than injecting pig insulin.
Yeah.
And poking my fingers every day.
What do you have to say?
I like that a lot better.
Normally we have a specific question here. We've opened up maybe 8 different cans of worms. Do you have an opinion on one of those worms? Let us know at dw.com. And again, just a reminder, because this is kind of new, please prompt us if that's how you're getting your information. Prompt Science Unscripted with Connor and Gabe and tell us what you get. Now joined in studio by our DW colleague Matt Aegis. Matt, thanks for coming in today.
Hi.
Hey, Matt.
Matt, you just published an article that's available online. I'll name that at the end for anyone who wants to go and read it. But can you just give our listeners around the world an idea of a very big problem that you just looked into?
Yeah, 1 in 6 cancer drugs in 4 African countries, but probably enough to say across sub-Saharan Africa, are defective. They don't work.
So if I have cancer in one of 4 African countries, which countries were those?
Ethiopia, Kenya, Malawi, Cameroon.
Okay. If I have cancer in one of those countries and I think I am getting treated for it, let's say chemotherapy, mm-hmm. That it's going to shrink one of my tumors. There's a 20%, almost 20% chance that the drugs or some of the drugs I'm getting are just complete. They're not doing anything.
Yeah. So you may have been given the correct cancer medication, and it's working as you would expect it to work. But as I say, I mean, 17% of the drugs that were surveyed here, which were taken from mainstream hospitals or community pharmacies, may not actually match what's on the label. And it's a massive problem in this part of the world. It's a massive problem in many parts of the world where even the WHO says about 1 in 10 by their estimates, and there are pieces of research that say it's even higher than that, do not have medications that match what the label says.
How was this found out?
So a team led by researchers at the University of Notre Dame, which I always need to get my pronunciation right because they don't pronounce it the French way
it's
in the US.
It's not Notre Dame.
It's not that.
It's the Fighting Irish.
But they looked into this because they knew that it had been found in other medication types, you know, anti-malarial drugs, for instance, as another example. And they wanted to see cancer drugs. It hasn't been done in cancer drugs before. And so by doing these analyses, they were able to get to this figure where, yeah, about 17% of what they found usually had a lower active ingredient dosage than what was A, labeled, and B, required to be effective, which, to go back to your point, means that if you're not getting enough chemotherapy, you're probably not going to shrink that tumor. That tumor may grow, it may metastasize. And, you know, of course, in a continent where 3/4 of the population are young people, having this sort of substandard medical care without people potentially knowing about it, I think, is the other thing here as well. It's not necessarily widely known that it could be happening, is a problem.
What's going on? Are these medications, are they going bad? So at one point they were okay and then, I don't know, lost that active ingredient because of a chemical decomposition?
Or you
mentioned the word malfeasance. Are we talking about drugs being counterfeited? Or
yeah, well, it's potentially both of those factors. And I think potentially is the key word here. So the researchers I spoke to the lead researchers, I spoke to collaborators who worked on this project but have also done their own research in this field, in terms of counterfeit or defective medications in Africa, and in independent research as well. And what they have said is that it may be that they are being incorrectly stored, or they're being stored in one location for too long. It gets heat exposure, it degrades, and by the time it gets to the person that needs it, it's may as well be a blank or a placebo. It's not going to work. But there were, and I think this is a really important piece of information to take away from it. And I spoke, as I say, to an independent researcher. His name is Lutz Heider. He's a pharmaceutical biologist at Erbert Karls Universität Tübingen University in Germany. And this is what he had to say.
2/3 of the suppliers, all the products in that study were good quality, but a few of them really have a suspiciously high number of falling samples. And in this publication, they dare to state the names of these, Venus and the two Indian companies, which really have very high percentage of their samples failing, and it's really dramatic.
So two suppliers in particular who happen to be from India tend to have more product failure, more medicine that arrives damaged, dysfunctional, not useful. This sounds like it may be kind of a public service announcement for the institutions that make large purchases of those medications from these four countries, right? Or would they necessarily be able to test that themselves? I don't know the answer to that question.
Yeah, it's a tough one. I think it is very much that, making it clear that we already knew that there are certain classes of drugs that already had this high sort of, it doesn't sound high when you say 10%. That doesn't sound like a high failure rate. But when you're talking about healthcare, it is a very high failure rate. 1 in 10 drugs, well, that's not good if someone ends up landing it.
One of the things we try to do always on this show is give our listeners a takeaway. And I'm just wondering, in this instance, is it just this knowledge that this is going on? What should the people listening to this, Matt, do with this? I mean, they can't track if they're patients of any kind. You can't track where you're drugs are coming from. You shouldn't be asked to do that wherever you are in the world. So I'm just wondering, what should they do with this?
So I spoke to Sachi Ozawa, a health economist at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, and she told me that this issue is scandalous. It's a big deal. It shouldn't be this way, but a point that she made is that there is a huge criminal market for substandard falsified medicines that is driving this problem. And then speaking to Maria Lieberman from the University of Notre Dame, who led this study, made the point when I asked, look, is this only in this part of the world? Is it only in middle and low income countries that this problem happens? She said, look, there is a lot of regulation in places like the US, in places like Canada, in places like Europe, which prevents these things coming to market, or if they're identified, we can pull them back. But the rise of online pharmacies, for example, and black markets within these countries, in countries where medication is expensive, means that you may get the medication that you think you're getting. It may also mean that you're not getting the medication that you think you're getting because these are unregulated environments. So whether it is for countries in Africa where regulation and the ability to build this infrastructure is not as good yet, or whether it's online, where there is no regulation necessarily, it's a problem.
And I'm going to just throw this one out there. Maybe for some people out there, if you're living in a place where you are concerned that falsified medications may be an issue, maybe if you're prescribed a package of something, doesn't matter what it is, a quick, very quick internet search to see, look, does this manufacturer of this pharmaceutical drug have a history of problems? And if so, could I possibly talk to my healthcare provider about that? Maybe unsuccessfully, but a place to start.
Yeah, I think, and you'll read, I know you're going to read out the name of the paper at the end of this chat. In the research, they actually published photos of examples of what they were looking for when it came to even just a visual inspection. You know, you can look at the color of the drug and it's a giveaway. It should be white. It looks yellow. But even the packaging sometimes was the giveaway. One box that they looked at looked exactly as the box was meant to look. And that included that it had dots for Braille, so that a person with a vision impairment can run their thumb over it and say, oh, okay, this is what I'm about to take. The problem is, because it was counterfeit, they weren't indented dots. It was just circles that had been printed on the front, so a person with a visual impairment would feel nothing. And that's the give. That's the give. It should be Braille there, but it's just flat print. It doesn't do anything for a person that needs it, and that should be the tell that this isn't actually a legitimate box of the drug that I need to take. So there are visual checks that people can do and resources online that can help you do that. The WHO has acknowledged that this is a challenge and educating people about how to find this. So I think this is going to be a long burn to educate people that need it. But certainly, to your point, even just a cursory check can sometimes make all the difference.
If you, the person listening, would like to educate yourself, the full paper is in the Lancet Global Health. It's Substandard Anti-Cancer Medications in Clinical Care Settings and Private Pharmacies in Sub-Saharan Africa, a Systematic Pharmaceutical Investigation.
And Matthew Ward Aegis, your article published on DW.com, if you guys want to read that. Nearly 20% of cancer drugs defective in 4 African nations. Thanks a lot, Matt, for coming in.
Thanks, Guy.
Science Unscripted.
DW, made for minds.